Today's Institute for Healthcare Improvement program is part one of six in the series on improving access and efficiency in the clinical office. And today's program title is Advanced Access, the New Paradigm for Office Practices and Clinics. And at this time, it's my pleasure to introduce your IHI moderator for today, Ms. Joanna Jaskolka. Joanna is project manager at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and is currently working on the office practices and outpatient settings domain of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement Impact Network. Joanna, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kurt, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for the first of our series of six calls to action audio conferences on improving access and efficiency in the clinical office. On behalf of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, I'd like to extend a warm welcome to each and everyone attending the series. We hope you've taken our advice and arranged for several members of your organization to participate as a team. The topic of today's first call is Advanced Access, the New Paradigm for Office Practices and Clinics. I'd like to introduce our faculty for today's call. Dr. Mark Murray, president of Mark Murray & Associates, is an internationally known expert in access to care, office practice redesign, and the flow of patients through complex systems of care. He has worked extensively in the U.S. and abroad and has authored numerous publications. As Kurt mentioned, please note your questions as we go through the didactic portion of today's call. We will conclude with a 30-minute question and answer period and hope to get to all of your questions then. Please refer now to page one of the presentation materials you received as Dr. Murray begins our audio conference series today. Dr. Murray?
Good morning. Thank you. Let me start off by saying that we often feel that an access to care problem or an access to care issue represents a deprivation of care. When we look at the old literature, we often see that when the word access is referenced, we're referring to populations that seem to be deprived of care. Well, at this point, an access problem really, in our view currently, is really not a deprivation of care issue at all, but actually a delay issue. So when we're talking about an access problem, we're really talking about a delay problem. We also know that an access problem is really a system problem. If we have a delay in our system, it's a result of the way that the system is designed. And in fact, Paul Batalden from Dartmouth has told us many times that every system is perfectly designed to get the results that it gets. What this means is that if we have a system that results in an access problem, in a delay, then that delay is a result of the system design. It also means is that if we want to change the results, we have to change the system. So one of the difficult issues about this whole subject is that in order to change things, we really have to look at it differently. So today we're going to talk a lot about how to look at systems, how to look at the systems that we use to provide care. And once we deconstruct them, we can see how we can reconstruct them in order to get better results. I don't really like the terms that we often use in this field. We use the term open access a lot. To me, that sounds like open season. So I've kind of gotten away from that term. There's another term, advanced access, that I actually invented, and that's the term that's used in the JAMA articles that I wrote last year, one with Don Berwick. And that term I've started to dislike as well, because it's starting to mean everything to everybody and hence nothing to nobody. What we're talking about with access to care is we're talking about not a product, and when we use terminology like open access and advanced access, we are implying that there's a specific product, but we're not talking about a product. What we're talking about is a process for improvement and a set of principles that we can use to reduce the waiting times or delays in our systems. Now there's another fellow that I like to quote as well, and since it's baseball season, I think this is apropos. And this quote comes from Yogi Berra, not Yogi Berra the baseball player, not Yogi Berra the cartoon guy, but Yogi Berra the baseball player said that if we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to keep getting what we got. If we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to keep getting what we got. So if we want to get something different, we got to do something different. To do something different, we have to see something different. So today we're going to talk about seeing things differently. Delays are really important for our patients in systems. And in fact, as we can reduce the waiting times or the delays across our systems, good things happen. Patient satisfaction goes up with reduction of waiting time. And if we look at patient satisfaction surveys, what we'll often see is that while patients are satisfied with their provider of care when they get to the office, they're often dissatisfied with the process or the waiting time or the delay that's required to get to that office. So we know that when the waiting time goes down, when the delay for an appointment goes down, when the access improves, that patient satisfaction goes up. We also know that staff satisfaction improves. It's very difficult for those staff folks who work with us to try to enable a process that's broken, to try to make appointments for patients when there are no appointments. When there is no product to sell, they're often frustrated and disgruntled by working in a system that really doesn't make much sense. So as the waiting time goes down, one of the things that we notice a lot is that the staff satisfaction goes up. In addition to that, as the waiting time goes down, provider satisfaction improves. I remember in my own practice, it was very difficult to have to spend the first 7.5 minutes of every visit in service recovery explaining why you had to wait and trying to assign some sort of blame for the waiting time and deflecting it from myself, of course. So as the waiting time goes down and I no longer have to explain or try to defend the waiting time, then my satisfaction goes up. Another interesting factor that's been shown and demonstrated a lot over the last 3 to 4 years is as the waiting time goes down, clinical outcomes improve. We've seen this definitely with clinical outcomes as measured by compliance with preventive service guidelines. Preventive service guidelines and the compliance with them improve dramatically with improved access. So as the waiting time goes down, our ability to see our own patients and to make sure that our own patients comply with those preventive services improves dramatically. In addition to that, we're also seeing now is that the care for our patients with chronic illness improves when access improves. The cornerstones, the critical design elements of improving access is getting patients in to see their own doctor without waiting. Getting patients in to see their own doctor without waiting is also a cornerstone in improving the care for our patients with chronic illness. So we're starting to see that the care for patients with asthma, diabetes, congestive heart failure, etc., all improve when the access to care improves. Another factor that we're seeing is that waiting times are costly. So as the waiting time goes down, the costs inside the system improve. The cost structure improves. So the costs improve. It actually turns out to be pretty expensive to make people wait. Whether we see that as an intentional make or not, in a sense, we've done that intentionally because we've designed the system that way. So as we redesign the system and there's less waiting times, there's less cost. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. The other interesting factor that we see, and this is somewhat counterintuitive, is that the revenues go up. As the waiting times go down, the revenues go up. I'm going to show you some data about that later. But this is a result of improved continuity, less service recovery time, and the opportunity, in a sense, to get down to business right away. So waiting times are not good. As we improve the waiting time, good things happen. So where are the waiting times? The waiting time, in a sense, is a constraint or a constriction or a bottleneck in a flow system. The first waiting time, and that's what we're going to discuss today in the access to care arena, is the waiting time from the world into the practice. So from the world, there's a request for a service, and that request for the service can be for anything, for information, for advice, for CBC, for any kind of clinical issue that we deliver. But when we talk about access to care, we're talking about the request for an appointment. So there's a waiting time between the request for the appointment that comes out of the population and when we provide or deliver that service. Now, in healthcare, we have this interesting paradigm. And what we say is that if you're really sick and you can prove it, then we'll see you. But if you're not so sick, you're going to wait. I mean, right there we have built in an acceptable waiting time because that's how we think. The second waiting time that we're not going to have a chance to discuss today is the waiting time across the office. And ultimately, we don't want to trade a waiting time from the world for a waiting time in the office. We can't get people in sooner only to have them wait across the office. So there's some other strategies to work on those waiting times as well. The third waiting time occurs when I, as a primary care doctor, see my patient and then refer that patient on to specialty care. There's a third waiting time there. And then deeper into the system, there's a multitude of other waiting times. We're going to focus primarily on the front door waiting time here from the world into primary care, the initial visit into primary care. So what's the process that we're going to use? What's the process that we're going to use in order to improve this? Well, the process really has four components, even though on my slide there's only listed three. The first component is team. Access to care improvement, access improvement is a team sport. We can't improve this alone. There's a whole system of care that's built up around how we provide access to care. So the solution really lies in taking all the people that actually do the work and having all those people who do the work together to improve that work. Secondly, we need an aim or a goal. In the beginning, we were somewhat aimlessly about 10 years ago when we were trying to improve access to care. But now it's pretty clear that the aim or goal in primary care really ought to be a single day. We can, because we know we can, reduce the waiting time in primary care to a single day. And in specialty care, I know we can reduce the waiting time to at least 5 days or less. Secondly, we need a name. Third thing we need is changes. I'm going to come back to those in a couple minutes. Those are what I call the high leverage changes or the access improvement principles. As Yogi said, if we keep doing what we're doing, we're going to keep getting what we got. So we have to make some changes. We have to do things differently. These changes really provide a framework or guideposts, a way to frame out and to look at what are the kinds of things that we have to do differently in order to achieve better results. Different practices will come up with different solutions, but the architecture, the change principles, really will be the same, whether this is radiology or primary care or specialty care. The architecture will be the same, but the solutions underneath that will be remarkably different. So there's a lot of room for reinvention in that way. And then finally, and fourthly, how do we know that all these changes that we've made have actually resulted in an improvement? How do we know we got better? Well, we need to measure. And what are we going to measure? Well, the primary thing we're going to measure is the waiting time. What is the delay? What's the waiting time? How long do people have to wait? The measure that I like to use is a measure called third next available. And what the third next available measurement does is that it measures system space, it measures capacity, it measures potential. And what we're looking for here is that if we take the most difficult appointment to get and we say, what's the third next available appointment of that type? How long do we have to wait before we could deliver on one of those? So it measures actually space. Now, a lot of people measure actual waiting time, you know, the distance between when the appointment was requested and when it was delivered. The difficulty with that, though, is that it's very difficult to say what's good because many of our patients return and have return visits that are absolutely necessary. And if we measure those, this obscures, in a sense, our a measurement of potential space. So measurement's the fourth most important thing, or process components. Measurement is the fourth. So how do I look at this? It's all about supply and demand. Every day, all day long, one patient at a time, one request at a time, what we're doing is we're matching supply to demand. The patients are the demand, we're the supply, and we balance or match that every day. And we can do that well or we can do that poorly, and it's really our choice. The gap or the distance, the time lapse between when the demand is initiated and when the supply is applied, that's the access problem. That's the delay. It's the distance between the demand and the supply. Our goal, our ultimate goal, is to get supply and demand in balance, to get a balance, achieve a balance between those two. If we measure by the year, by the quarter, by the month, by the week, by the day, by the hour, by the minute, and what we discover is that there's more demand than there is supply. And again, measured by the year, the quarter, the month, the week, the hour, or the minute. If there's more demand than there is supply, there is no system in the world that's going to solve that problem. On the other hand, if we can get supply and demand in balance and deal with the variation of both supply and demand, then we you know, the sky's the limit. We can reduce the waiting time, the gap between those two things, to a day. So our strategies are going to be around looking at that current gap and the effect of that current gap, and then looking at how can we, if we need to, effectively and appropriately reduce the demand, and how can we, if we need to, effectively and appropriately increase the supply. Reducing the demand does not mean depriving people of care, and increasing the supply does not mean hiring. The next slide is what I call the reservoir. And the reservoir is, in a sense, a good illustration of how we work in healthcare. We have demand coming in, and we have supply going out, and we have a lake or a reservoir of waiting. This is, in a sense, an inventory or a warehouse. And, in fact, one group I worked with a couple weeks ago said that basically in healthcare, as we look at the patient's journey horizontally across the system, what we're doing is we're moving patients from one warehouse to another, from one lake to another. And they likened it to the Panama Canal, where there's a series of locks. So we're putting the boat in the lock, filling the water, putting the boat in the next lock. So there's a series of waiting times all the way across healthcare. So let's take a look at that and the effect of that. If the patient's really sick, they get right through this lake. And if they can prove it, they get right through the lake. So that, in a sense, is not a problem. We do quite well in access to care when patients are really sick and can prove it. On the other hand, if you can't prove it, then there's an enforced wait. Now, what I often see in systems is that this enforced wait stabilizes, that the demand in and the supply out are balanced at a month or 2 months. And what I say about that is that if we look at the waiting time, and despite some oscillations on the surface, if we look at the waiting time and the waiting time is stable, what we're doing is we're balancing supply and demand all right. We're just a month or two too late. So what's the effect of that month or two too late? The first effect is that the longer people wait, the higher the no-show. And on the one hand, no-shows represent unused system capacity. And on the other hand, no-shows represent system work. If we have a 10 to 20% no-show rate, what it means is that 10 to 20% of our staff work that was used to make that appointment, to pull the chart if we have to, et cetera, that work goes unused. It's, in effect, wasted. Secondly, the longer people wait, there's more rework. I just did some work in Minneapolis a couple weeks ago, and one of the groups there told me that they estimated, and I think they're probably exaggerating a bit, that 40 to 50% of the receptionist's work every day was just in rework, was basically in teaching people how to tread water as they're in the lake, you know, sending them inner tubes and keeping them entertained. There is a lot of rework that goes on in that waiting time. There's phone calls that come into the practice. There's patients that probe the perimeter, that try to find another way into to another provider. Symptoms get embellished. Patients go to emergency departments. They go to urgent care clinics. We send them out to have a test so they can be entertained while they're waiting. So there's multiple different things that occur during this waiting time. In addition, the longer people wait, the more we have to triage. And triage is kind of the act of sorting out the work. And triage in the sense of sorting the work into who waits or who doesn't wait, frankly, is waste. Now, triage in the sense of getting the patient on the correct route for care, that's value. But sorting the work and deciding who waits and who does not wait is not value. So the longer people wait, the more we have to sort. And what we find is that often a lot of our precious resources are used up in sorting, and that's not working. So as the waiting time goes down, these forms of waste, the failed acutes, the reworks, and the triages, those all go away. So if we're going to redesign a system, and if we want to look at a system and improve it, what do we want to do? What are our critical design elements? Well, there's really two. We have to solve the continuity issue, and we have to solve the capacity issue. Now, we can solve either one of these in isolation. We can get patients in to have them see their own doctor, continuity. But in order to do that, what we often do is make people wait. We can get patients in, and we can get them in soon. We can get everybody in soon, but we often have to sacrifice the continuity. So the real trick here is to get our patients into us without waiting, get patients into their own doctor without waiting. So there really are two critical design elements. Now, all this stuff is all about matching supply and demand. How is it in healthcare that have we chosen to match supply and demand? What are the choices we've made in the past? What are the models that we've used in the past? How have we actually gotten into this mess? There's three ways that we've chosen to match supply and demand. And if we actually look at other industrial models, even though they may use different terminology and different words, they use some variation on these three models as well. The first model in healthcare, I call the traditional model. And I don't think anybody's using this anymore because it's so dissatisfying. But in a traditional model, the provider of care goes to work, and her schedule is full, and her schedule's been full for a month. Now we got this problem of patients, and we got this problem of patients who are sick. Because remember, we have this paradigm in healthcare between urgent and non-urgent. So patients call us up. Some of them can prove that they're sick, and the proving that they're sick is actually a long process often. Patient calls, gets through the phone fog, talks to the receptionist, proves that they're sick. Receptionist asks a whole bunch of questions and then passes them on to a licensed professional, usually a nurse. Patient has to prove again that they're sick. Then the work gets delayed again. The doctor gets asked for her permission to be able to overbook that patient onto the schedule. Patient gets called back. And there's a whole cascade of waiting times, a series of puddles, as it were, in order to accomplish this. So patient may call us up and declare that they're sick at 8 o'clock in the morning. By the time we get around to it, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and we wonder why we have trouble getting done at the end of the day. So in a traditional model, the way that we get capacity is we overbook an already full schedule. And the way we get the continuity is we either overbook an already full schedule or we make patients wait to the end of the line or the end of the queue. When we run out of capacity, when we get super saturated, we send the work over there. We send the work to somebody else, you know, to the other doctor, to the doctor that has the first open appointment, you know, enforced discontinuity. We send the work to urgent care. We send the work to the emergency department. And when we send the work away from us, as the work cascades away from us, the revenues go down, the costs go way up, the clinical outcomes are adversely affected. Patient, provider, and staff satisfaction is all adversely affected. So it's not a good way of doing the work. Our patients rebelled against this about 10, 15 years ago. And they said, when we're ill, sick, and vulnerable, we want to see our own doctors. So build something different for us. That actually propelled the evolution of what I call a carve-out model. And what a carve-out model is, it's a saturated model with some of that space inside the saturated model carved out. And this is the next slide that illustrates this. So that there's a component of the saturated schedule that's carved out or saved or preserved or frozen or hidden or delay released, or there's numerous different terminologies for this. So what we do is we take the saturated model, we carve out a component of it, and we say we're going to save that or hold it for patients with urgent care needs. So in a sense, this is an improvement. Our patients then that are ill, sick, and vulnerable have, once they can prove that they're sick enough and meet the criteria, they have a place to be put. So we have a place, and that place can be either on the schedule of one doctor in the practice. You know, if we have a doctor of the day or a Jeopardy doctor or a walk-in doctor, drop-in doctor, this is actually a carve-out model with one doctor performing that function. Or another evolution of that is that every doctor's cut part of her schedule that's carved out or saved. Now, in the illustration on the 11th slide, I demonstrate this here. We have a carve-out view, one carve-out model with one month view. And what we see here is that the routine appointments, the non-urgent appointments, fill up 3.5 weeks of the schedule. And then we finally, at the end of that, we have some open space. And then the carved-out appointments, the held appointments, the frozen appointments, they fill up, and I just illustrated this with 50% carve-out, they fill up the second half of the day in perpetuity. Now, I made an assumption here with 50%, and it doesn't have to be 50%, doesn't have to be morning and afternoon, and it doesn't necessarily have to be each doctor, but I'm making that assumption on this slide. So the problems occur in these carve-out models is, despite the fact that we can often get our patients in who are sick to their own doctor today, these systems, often called open access, are really they're not open, and they're often very inflexible. And here are the problems that occur. The more space that we carve out, the longer the waiting time for the non-carved out appointments go. So, for example, if we have a 1 month wait and we carve out 50% for same day urgents, the 1 month wait for the non-urgents now goes out to 2 months. It's like a balloon. We squeeze it and it goes out. So that doesn't really solve the problem. It actually makes the problem worse. So, you know, and as Paul Batalden would say, every system is perfectly designed to get the results that it gets. So now some of those patients who said, I can wait a month, can't wait 2 months. So there's a tendency then to create another line or another queue, another appointment type. And then pretty soon we're in the appointment type cascade, creating all different appointment types, squeezing out more and more space out of the schedule, sending the non-urgents out even further. In addition, there's another couple problems that occur. If we see a patient today who's sick and they need to come back again, there's no space. There's no place to put them because the future, the immediate future anyway, is either filled or held. So what we do is either one of two things, both of which don't make any sense. The first is we tell them to call back. Call us back on Friday when the appointments open up. Our patients don't understand that. You mean you have an appointment on Friday. You can tell, you can see it, but you can't give it to me. No, I can't. You got to call me back on Friday. Makes no sense. And it also gums up the phones. The other thing we'll do is that in order to circumvent that, what we'll do is what we'll often do is steal those future appointments. So we'll take those appointments and steal them. And then what we're doing is we're right back into a saturated model. Now, the third model is that there's another way of doing this. And this is what we used to call advanced access model, but I call it do today's work today model. In this model, it's a little bit different. What we're doing here is we're eliminating the distinction between urgent and routine. This is a huge paradigm shift in healthcare. This is a totally different way of doing the work. So what we're saying is that we're going to eliminate the distinction between urgent and routine, and what we're going to do is we're going to deliver what the patient wants. They want to see their own doctor without waiting. So we're going to pull that work into today. Now, I'm going to come back to the fears about this in a second. Okay. Now, what this means is that the vast majority of the work is done and is completed each day. Patients call up, no distinction between urgent and routine. We find out who their doctor is. We appoint them today. Now, the question comes, is what happens to those patients who don't want to be seen today? And initially, when most groups work on these kind of changes in paradigm, a lot of patients are not prepared to be seen today. But as time goes on, those patients that get used to that, and they say, you know, every time I call those guys, they ask me what time do I want to be seen that day, so they shift their behavior and start calling us on the day they want to be seen. And it turns out that about 80 to 85% of the patients that call us will accept an appointment today. Those who don't, that 15 to 20% who don't, what we can do is we can book them into the future. I don't really believe in not booking future appointments. A lot of people interpret the terminology and interpret the work as what we're going to do is we're going to do the work every day, but we're never going to appoint people into the future. I don't think that makes any sense. Our patients need the dignity and respect of a follow-up appointment and the dignity and respect of being able to make an appointment for tomorrow. So the second component of so-called good backlog are those patients who we see today that we bring back again. Now, I know that my own personal myth is that if I see people today and I bring them back again, that will automatically fill up the future. Well, it really doesn't. We think that it does, but it really doesn't. It's almost you have to try it to believe it. So there's two components of people that get put onto the future. Those patients who choose not to be seen today and those patients who are seen today who need to be brought back again. Now, the slide on 12 shows, in a sense, those categories, an open category and then categories for patient choice and returns. In a live and living system, the distinctions between the open and the return and the patient choice appointments, those distinctions would be blurred. And there really wouldn't be a carved out space for those particular kinds of patients, or in a sense even a limit for those kinds of patients. So what are our fears? What makes us afraid about this? Well, the first thing that makes us afraid is that I can't possibly do this because my schedule is full. My schedule is saturated. Well, what's that? My schedule is saturated because last month I didn't do last month's work last month or last week's work last week, and I pushed the work forward. So my schedule is saturated because of an old paradigm. So that's really a backlog issue or a front log issue or a warehouse issue or a reservoir issue or lake issue. The second fear is that demand is insatiable. If I do this, demand will completely overwhelm me. Well, that's where measurement comes into place. We have to measure what's the demand, what's the supply, and compare the two. Again, if demand is bigger than supply, there's no system in the world that's going to work. And a system that says we're not going to see you, we're going to commit to see you, but we're going to put you further and further out on the schedule. That's a system that's not sustainable. So the key on the demand is insatiable is to measure it. In addition, we often see that if the waiting time stabilizes, what that means is supply and demand are in balance. We're just late. The next fear, which is kind of a drill down fear, is the fear of panel size. Is that I can't do this because my panel is too big. Well, what is panel? What panel is my part of the practice, my part of the pie, my part of the work that I'm supposed to do. And in a sense, it's the demand. You know, the work, the population, divided by the supply. So a panel size is the demand in the practice divided by the supply in the practice. So just as at an organizational level, supply and demand need to be in balance, at a practice level, supply and demand need to be in balance, and at the individual level, at the panel size level, supply and demand need to be in balance. In order to move through this, though, in order to be able to do today's work today, we really have to put up with variation. We have to understand the variation on the supply side and control that with time off policies and bookable hours and that kind of thing. Now, interestingly enough, doctors often think that what this means is that I have less time off and my time off is controlled. But what we actually see is that we actually have more control over our time off. And a lot more flexibility since there's not a huge backlog and bumps and cancellations that we have to deal with. On the other hand, we also have to put up with demand side variation. What we used to do is make the patients take all the variation. What we're saying now is that the patients aren't going to take the variation, we will. So we'll respond to that. We'll absorb that variation and we'll take it. We'll measure it and manage it and do what we can with it. And the piece of the variation that we have a lot of control over is the return visits, and we'll use the return visits to fill in the future at the places where we want to fill in the future, but we'll absorb that variation. Now, if you look around in other industries and other businesses quite commonly manage the variation. Macy's at Christmas. People that work more in the summer than in the winter. You know, in other industries and businesses, there's a lot of absorbing of variation, either on a daily basis, a seasonal basis, or whatever. So what's the paradigm shift here? How are we seeing this differently? Well, the old paradigm is that what we say is that in order to protect today, we push the work out to the future. We push the work till tomorrow. Today's schedule is precious and we don't have enough of it. So what we're going to do is push a good part of that work out to the future. And by pushing that work out to the future, we clutter the future and make it very inflexible. The new paradigm, and this is a new way of thinking here, and I think it's really difficult to see, what we say is that in order to protect tomorrow, what we're going to do is we're going to pull all the work into today. So the way we're going to get space or capacity tomorrow is what we're going to do is we're going to do all the work today. We're going to be so good today that there's no work left and tomorrow will be open. This involves, in a sense, a leap of faith. It involves measurement. But what it results in is a system of care that's designed not to have patient waiting times, but is designed to minimize or eliminate patient waiting times. So what are the results of that system with its new design? Patient satisfaction is improved. As the waiting time goes down, satisfaction goes up. Patients then get the option, the choice. I can be seen today for anything. So I have the space or the capacity inside of your system so that I can choose. Staff satisfaction is improved. We actually have appointments. We have appointments to deliver, and we can do that freely and easily. It improves staff satisfaction, staff retention, staff morale, and reduces their workload. Provider satisfaction is improved. I don't go to work with a full schedule and have to defend myself. The delays, obviously, are reduced. Continuity is improved because, again, the critical design elements in this approach is that what we want to recognize is that we have two problems to solve. Not only do we have the access, the delay issue to solve, but we have the delay issue to the individual provider to solve. So what we see is that as we make these improvements, the continuity improves and improves dramatically. Clinical quality is improved. Unnecessary visits are reduced. Now, unnecessary visits are basically system churn. These are visits where I'm full, can't see my patient, so you see my patient. And then what happens is they more frequently than not come back again to get their need met with their own doctor. So the system churn is reduced. And there's some financial improvement. So let me walk you through some of these. The first run chart there is an example of from a group in the upper Midwest. And this was a group that had a 25-day waiting time for a physical exam, you know, whatever that means anymore, 25-day waiting time. So the third next available appointment, on average, in this department of 12 family medicine doctors was 25 days. Now, this group applied the process that we talked about and the principles that I'll go through in a couple minutes and reduced the waiting time over a period of a few months from 25 days to a department average of about 2.5. This department average included those doctors who were absent. So if a patient wanted a so-called physical and their doctor was present, then they could get it that day. The next slide shows improvement in continuity. This was a group in California who had a 47% continuity in a saturated model. As they moved across the saturated model into a carve-out model, they improved the continuity to 59%. But as they moved into Do Today's Work Today model, the third model, where continuity is basically a system design, the continuity improved to 72%. This is the next slide is demonstrates improvement in clinical outcome. This is a family medicine practice in the Midwest, and this is a group that's very conscious about clinical care improvement. At the same time, in this group of eight family medicine doctors, they had a 3.5-week wait for a routine appointment. They were a little disturbed because they were losing patients to their competitors. So not only were they losing patients to their competitors, their continuity was really poor. So patients said, I like my doctor when I can see her, but I don't necessarily always see her, and I have to wait. So they embarked upon a project to improve continuity and to improve the waiting times. They got the waiting time down from those 3.5 weeks down to a day, and they improved the continuity by lining up the accountabilities. So they actually decided whose patients were whose. Now, incidental to all this work, they were measuring clinical outcomes, or actually it's probably not outcomes, but it's a process measure. They were measuring compliance with preventive services. And between the fourth quarter of 1998 and the first quarter of year 2000, their screening rates improved dramatically. Pap smear screening rates, mammography screening rates, and the key one is the bottom one. It's the percentage of services complete. Each patient sits in a subcell. 55-year-old man has certain requirements for preventive services, and a 33-year-old woman has another set. So they looked at how often did we complete the whole set, and they went from 60% to 93%. They won their organization's Clinical Quality Improvement Work Award for this work. Now, in a sense, they had no intention of doing this. This was an unintended consequence. They took credit for it, of course, but it was an unintended consequence. And what it pointed out to me was is that as we improve the continuity and reduce the delay, what we're going to see is a lot better clinical outcomes. This has been born